Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Senate Healthcare Committee. It is March 21st. I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 861. Oliver, do you want to bring us up to date?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 861, brought to you by the Oregon Health Authority. The bill removes a hospital reporting exemption in Oregon for healthcare organizations defined as group practice payment healthcare plans that operate hospitals in the state. There are no impact statements and no amendments. Testimony is available on OLIS.
Okay, John Collins.
Afternoon, Chair Monis-Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, and members of the committee. For the record, I am Dr. John Collins. I'm the Director of the Office of Health Analytics, which is in the Health Policy and Analytics Division of the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about Senate Bill 861, which is a bill to strengthen the Health Authority's collection of financial data from hospitals. As authorized by ORS 442-425, Oregon Health Authority collects financial data from Oregon's hospitals on an ongoing basis. One data set is collected annually and consists of each hospital's audited financials. The other data set is collected monthly and consists of each hospital's self-reported, unaudited financial information. It includes data elements such as gross patient charges, contractual amounts, operating expenses, payroll expenses, and utilization figures for inpatient, outpatient, emergency room, and other settings. Today, two of Oregon's 60 hospitals are exempted in statute from reporting their individual financial data. This bill seeks to close that exemption. In lieu of the data elements that all other hospitals must report, the exempted hospitals instead submit a national health system-wide audited financial statement and handful of hospital-specific data elements. We know from the limited data that we obtain from these hospitals that they account from over 120,000 patient visits, over $800 million in operating revenue, and over $50 million in net income in 2015. These statistics are not included in statewide analyses of Oregon's hospitals' financial health because necessary information is still missing. Gross charges, net patient revenue, operating expense, and operating and total margins are metrics reported or calculated by the health authority for all other hospitals in the state except these two. While the need for complete and accurate data may be sufficient rationale to end this exemption, there are other compelling reasons. Once collected, all of the hospital's financial data are made publicly available. This gives the exempted hospitals a competitive advantage in that they can access other hospitals' data while their own are missing from the data set. Also of concern is the relatively broad statutory language, which allows hospitals that receive a preponderance of their revenue from associated comprehensive group practice prepayment healthcare service plans to report as a group rather than as individual institutions. As the healthcare landscape shifts, large hospital systems and organizations will increasingly adopt capitation and managed care models. This could result in more of Oregon's largest hospitals falling under this exemption and reporting at the aggregate level only in the future. Lastly, this statute was enacted decades ago when the healthcare model system was very unique, and reporting this type of data would have been problematic. Since that time, extensive guidelines from the Financial Accounting Standards Board exist about how to handle capitation and prepayment of healthcare and financial reporting. Other hospitals already follow these guidelines in reporting their financial data to the Oregon Health Authority with respect to the care they provide on capitated Medicaid and Medicare Advantage arrangements. Thank you for your time and careful consideration of this bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Question? Is Kaiser Sunnyside and Kaiser?
West Side.
All right. Stay there, and then we'll bring up Amy Hafave. Hopper.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis-Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Favre. I'm with Kaiser Permanente. Thank you for the opportunity to present testimony today in opposition to Senate Bill 861. Kaiser Permanente Northwest, as many of you know, is made up of four separate legal entities: Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, Northwest Permanente Medical Group, Permanente Dental Associates, and Kaiser Foundation Hospitals. Together, these entities provide integrated care for over 550,000 members in Oregon and Southwest Washington. Kaiser Permanente operates two hospitals in Oregon, as you mentioned, Kaiser Sunnyside Medical Center and Kaiser Westside Medical Center. As you just heard, Senate Bill 861 deletes from statute provisions that allow facilities that are part of a comprehensive prepaid health care services plan to use their established accounting systems and to report costs and revenues in a manner consistent with those systems and generally accepted accounting principles. It also deletes provisions that allow such organizations to report data as a group rather than as an individual institutional level when those facilities are operated as part of group health facilities. As a managed care organization, Kaiser Permanente budgets, plans, and forecasts from a consolidated view that encompasses both the health plan and the hospitals. As part of an integrated system, our hospitals are cost centers as opposed to revenue centers. Hospitals that are not part of an integrated system derive revenue from patients who come through the door. Kaiser Permanente's revenue comes through our health plan premiums as opposed to fee-for-service payments for services and supplies. In addition, we monitor and manage financial performance at a consolidated level rather than at the individual hospital level. We do not view our hospitals as profit centers that are intended to operate as standalone businesses and realize specific rates of return. This perspective is reflected in our accounting and financial reporting and sets us apart from other health systems. We simply do not track financial data in a way that could provide the data currently requested by the Oregon Health Authority directly from our accounting systems. Significant cost allocations to each hospital would have to be developed, and that would cause the data to be potentially misleading in comparison to other organizations. Rather than create a level field and gather the accurate data that I've heard is desired, Kaiser Permanente would be forced to report data that is not comparable to data that is reported by other hospitals in the state. To illustrate our challenge, I wanted to give a few examples that are in the written testimony that I submitted of data points that we would be required to submit. One is Medicare inpatient charges. For certain lines of businesses, such as Medicare, Kaiser Foundation Hospitals is paid on a capitated per member per month payment basis that is not based on specific services provided during that period of time. Second, net patient revenue. Patient services revenues are not recorded within our financial statement for any line of business by individual hospital. Accordingly, bad debt, charity care, and contractual allowances at the patient level are unconnected to the location of services. We don't track them that way. And then the third example I will give is around physician payroll amount. Under the health plan's contract with our medical group, we pay a capitated per member per month payment that is not connected to services provided during that period. This payment is to provide care for Kaiser Permanente members, whether they are seen in the clinic or in the hospital. Additionally, the bulk of the administrative costs are incurred by the health plan and allocated to Kaiser Foundation hospitals through cost drivers. These are not calculated nor allocated at the individual hospital level. Mr. Collins referred to the Financial Accounting Standards Board guidelines, and I need to respectfully push back on the contention that other hospitals are following these guidelines and therefore Kaiser Permanente should too. Kaiser Permanente complies with generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP, including the Financial Accounting Standards Board guidelines related to reporting capitation and prepaid health care. However, our underlying contracts and payment arrangements are different than non-managed care organizations. Accounting treatment follows legal agreements and the underlying requirements of those contracts, such as the payment arrangement from between our medical group and the hospitals, and between the hospitals and the health plan. All of that is to say that our contracts are different than other hospitals, and therefore our accounting systems are different too. In addition, the guidance does not comment on reporting requirements at the individual hospital level based on cost allocations. GAAP in this case would relate only to the consolidated hospital financial reporting, which our two hospitals roll up into the national Kaiser Foundation hospital reporting that includes all of the other Kaiser hospitals that are located in Hawaii and California. In addition, I would be remiss if I didn't address Mr. Collins' contention that Kaiser Permanente enjoys some sort of competitive advantage by not reporting this data. I want to clearly state for the record that we derive no competitive advantage from not reporting this data, since we do not establish prices per se for our hospitals, and they are not revenue centers. We have no need to look at other hospitals' financial results to determine how ours compare. For the past decade, Oregon has been working to move away from the fee-for-service model and to encourage alternate payment methods, integrated care models, and value-based care. State policy has gradually shifted to encourage and in some cases mandate that we pay for care in a way that promotes health rather than reimbursing every individual service and supply. CCOs and the required hospital reimbursement for PEB plans are just two examples of that. If passed, Senate Bill 861 would require Kaiser Permanente to pretend that we are not an integrated system and to attempt to back into numbers that fill OHA's buckets. Rather than force Kaiser Permanente and other health systems that may move away from the free-for-service model in the future to report numbers that would not accurately represent the cost of care, I submit that the state would be better served by taking a fresh look at the reporting requirements and investigating how to truly capture the cost data that they desire. As more hospitals become part of integrated systems, it begs the question of whether we should be locking ourselves into a reporting system in which fee-for-service data becomes less and less meaningful, or moving on to new ways of measuring health outcomes. Kaiser Permanente would be pleased to partner with the health authority in this effort. I ask you for your support in opposing this bill. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, questions? Senator Knope.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mr. Collins, it says this was at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. Who in the Oregon Health Authority wanted or requested this information?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Knope. This is actually collected under ORS 442-425, where we collect financial information for all the hospitals, and we were just looking to complete our data set out of the 60 hospitals or so that report. These are the only two that we are not able to include and report on and publicly for the people of Oregon.
Sure, but that didn't actually answer my question. So who at the Oregon Health Authority wanted this particular bill?
Sorry. Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Canope, I think that's an internal process. So the way we do bills inside
State your
of
the, name for the record.
Oh, sorry, for the record, Justin Black from OHA. So the way we do bills in OHA is that each division looks at their current workload, looks at current problems out there, comes up with possible bills. The agency, through the legislative process, has about 25 bills this legislative session. So this is one of those bills that went through that process. So it goes through, you know, it goes through the division, it goes through the director. We run it by the governor's office because we're part of the executive branch, and that's how we do it.
Follow up. So, Justin, did somebody talk to Kaiser and let them know that you're introducing a bill to request information from them?
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Crump. No, and we do need to apologize for that. This was, when we were going through the process over the summer, this came up. It didn't feel like an urgent at that time. During this legislative session, we've gotten more requests for hospital data than we've ever received. And as we were releasing hospital report after hospital report and that kind of asterisk that was included in the reports, it became an increasing hole in the data that we were providing legislators as you all are making decisions about hospitals.
So, Madam Chair, just follow up. So, is OHA in a position to, based on Amy's testimony, this sounds like it would be pretty complicated to kind of break their information apart because clearly they do stuff differently. And so is OHA in a position to absorb the cost that it would take for Kaiser to provide you the information?
What?
Sounds like Mr. Collins would like to answer this question. He's leaning forward.
Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Canope, no, we had not anticipated reimbursing Kaiser any costs for them deriving this information. Like, we don't do that for any of the other hospitals as well.
Well, sure, but the other hospitals' data isn't probably the same as Kaiser's.
No, Chair Monsanto, Senator Knope, I would.
You don't agree?
I would say that basically all the hospitals have very complicated accounting systems. Some of them have fee-for-service reimbursement systems. Others are capitated for some of the care that they provide, and they're able to fulfill the reporting requirements that we have. Granted, they are not the same as the Kaiser system, but we still feel that Kaiser could work with us to report the data elements so that we have equitable, fair comparisons across the hospitals that we could report on.
Senator Steiner Hayward, or do you want follow-up?
No, go ahead.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Favre, the first question is not a gotcha question at all. It's just trying to, there's a piece I don't know. Are all of your physician employees paid on straight salary?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, I believe that is true. As you know, I'm still fairly new to Kaiser, and I understand that they are paid on salary. I don't know if there are any exceptions to that rule,
okay,
but I'd be happy to find that out for you.
All right. I guess my question becomes, when you do cost accounting, I would think, but maybe I'm wrong, that when you think about bringing people in for a routine gallbladder surgery, right? Planned, like not an emergency, laparoscopic gallbladder surgery, right? You have a way of knowing how much you're paying the nurses, right? For the time that the patient's in the hospital, it's that time in the OR, because they're paid on salary and an hourly rate, right? You have a way of knowing what the cost of the drugs is that you provide for that patient. You have a way of accounting for the supplies, the cost of the supplies that you use in caring for that patient. You can amortize the cost as you would do in any other situation of the fixed equipment, the reusable equipment, the laparoscope, the associated instruments, over the cost over the course of caring for patients. It might be tough to say for a general surgeon what percentage of his or her salary comes from taking care of doing that gallbladder surgery, and certainly that's the kind of thing where for a lot of situations that might be considered a lump payment, right? They would get pre-op, the surgeon would provide pre-op care, they provide operative and post-operative care, they provide follow-up care, and a lot of insurance pays that on a case basis, not on a per-visit basis. So I guess, and believe me, I get that your system's set up a little bit differently, but I guess I'm thinking that there ought to be some way to account for at least a largest chunk of your costs associated with caring for these patients. Or am I missing something key here?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Steiner-Hayward, we pay our physicians to care for our members regardless of where they are.
Sure.
And so we don't currently always track. We don't track sort of where those costs are going on an institutional level. That's not to say that we couldn't derive costs, as you suggest, through a series of cost allocations. So they would be taking our best guesses and looking at the how we do track the costs and splitting them up among the different hospitals. And we could put a number in a box. But how accurate that number is to actually reflect the cost of those services is, I think, where it gets tricky. And when I've heard this, the desire of OHA is to have complete and accurate numbers, I would contend that they would not necessarily be entirely accurate numbers. But it is, you know, I think you raise a good point that there's 109 financial fields in one of the forms that the OHA would require us to fill out under this bill. And I think each one we would have to sit down and look at and discuss, you know, how could we go about doing this in a way that might make sense. I think our concern about this bill is that it wholesale requires us to start filling out this form immediately under the penalty of civil damages or civil penalties. And so, you know, we're willing to sit down with the Oregon Health Authority and talk to them about ways that might make sense. And we would have certainly in the interim if we had been afforded that opportunity, and we're certainly happy to going forward.
Madam Chair, thank you. So, Mr. Collins, when you mentioned that other hospitals have issues because some of them are paid on a capitation rate and some of them are paid on a fee-for-service rate and some of them have blended models, I don't even know how to ask this question. For the any other hospital people who are listening, please don't assume that I – please take this in the right way. I would venture to guess they have as much trouble doing those forms, as Ms. Favre just said, they would have doing at Kaiser. I mean, I don't think that OHSU or Prov Portland or Legacy Emmanuel specifically counts how many 4x4s or bags of fluid they hang for a laparoscopic cholecystectomy, gallbladder surgery, but they have some way of figuring out what that costs, right? So I guess from my perspective, it'd be kind of helpful as I think about this bill to hear from you, first of all, how you think they're getting those data that they give you, and second of all, frankly, from another hospital that is subject to this requirement already, about how they analyze their data so that they can complete it to your satisfaction. And last but not least, 109 forms, did you say?
Fields.
Data
points.
I'm less concerned than that. Yeah. I've done 109 forms. That would have caused me to flip out a little bit.
So, Senator Beyer.
Well, I think Mr. Collins wanted to.
Oh, Mr. Collins.
Sure. Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward. I don't have that information with me right now, but I'd be happy to bring it back to the committee to share some of the examples of how other hospitals deal with their various financing systems.
That'd be helpful. Thank you.
Sure.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I certainly understand why you'd want the information, but I understand when you're accounting for it as a whole insurance program, I'm not sure. I guess I would say that you probably could find a way to do cost allocation methodology to fill out the form, but I'm not sure when you finish that it would provide any data that was apples to apples. I mean, having done that in different arenas, I'm not sure that you would get that data that would be acceptable. You've obviously thought about that.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Beyer, that is a reasonable question to ask, and I assume we could probably ask that same question across all the various hospitals that we report. I mean, with the forms that we issue and the way we describe the instructions that we give for responding, we try and create a situation where we can have as standardized responses across the various hospitals as we can. And but to some extent, I'm sure there is some variation in how the various hospitals do answer the questions.
I guess I would challenge it. I can see in most hospitals that are not the insurer, they're delivering a fee-for-service basis to a multitude of clients, but that's really different than an insurance plan that's operating its own facilities. It just seems that you have a lot of combined costs there that you can cost allocate out, but I think you could do that. I'm not sure that what the end product that you're going to get is comparable, which is what you're trying to do.
Well, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Beyer, I think what we want to be able to do is publicly report what each hospital is reporting for its finances in a similar fashion that we do for a lot of our other providers. For example, our coordinated care organizations operate under a number of different models. I mean, the mm-hmm. state capitates each one of them for care, but then within their systems, they might have subcapitation arrangements, fee-for-service arrangements, various other kinds of models for handling their care, as I'm sure most all the hospitals do. But at the same time, we have to keep track of how much each CCO, for example, is spending on health care and break it up into groups of information that seem relevant to us and stakeholders, legislature, et cetera. And I feel that we could probably do the same thing with the Kaiser hospitals, which is what we want to do. Hmm.
Any other questions? Do you want to make any comment?
Oh. Chair Mona Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Stephen Ranzoni. I'm a hospital policy advisor for the Office of Health Analytics under Dr. Collins here. The point I wanted to make is sort of to help out this idea of how hospitals are able to report their financials across multiple different reimbursement mechanisms. The key to a lot of it, and put in very simple terms, is that everything starts with a concept that all hospitals have a base price for what they do, a charge master rate, as it were, which I think is a concept many of you might be familiar with. There's this idea that, you know, if you have an appendix surgery, for example, at a hospital, this hospital has this number out there, and it says it's $10,000 or whatever. And that's just the starting point. And we know that across all these other mechanisms that a hospital is probably not ever going to get $10,000. One payer will pay it $8,000, Medicare will pay it $6,000, or, you know, all these things. But the idea is how we can account for care is that a hospital will set a rate to begin with for all the procedures they do. And then we can account for the difference based on the money that they get. And that is the mechanism with which across all these systems that we can account for care. And that difference that we track is called that contractual rate, another concept that might have been heard. And so when we're talking about all these other hospital systems, these, you know, large-scale ones such as Providence, who do, you know, a tremendous amount of volume, both fee-for-service and capitation and subcapitation, it all boils down to the same similar system, which is everything they do starts with a basic price. They may not necessarily get, but this is basic ability to value something, and then account on accrual basis every time that they do it, how much money then trickles in the door across that.
Chair, may I make a comment?
All right.
Based on that, Chair Monasanderson, thank you. I think the description I just heard, and I don't pretend to understand very well how other hospitals do their systems, but I do know that in general, hospitals are considered revenue centers. And what you just described to me is a model where hospitals are paid a certain amount for the services that they provide and the care that they provide. At Kaiser Permanente, our hospitals are cost centers. We don't derive revenue from our hospitals. And I think that is precisely what sets us apart here and makes our challenges different in reporting this data.
I do know that we have had a big discrepancy between what one hospital charges versus another hospital. We've heard that numerous times here, and I like the idea of being able to be transparent, especially when we're using taxpayer money. Because it was sprung on Kaiser at last minute, I really would like to have some negotiation and work done between the Oregon Health Authority and Kaiser in working out what would be feasible. CCOs is not a fee-for-service. Well, it has some fee-for-service, but it is an insurance model also, if you want to look at it from that point of view. So I would hope that you could try to work out a method that would be workable for both, if that's all right with you, and if that's all right with the committee. Okay. Thank you very much. I will close the public hearing on 861 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 147.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 147, brought to you by Senators Girard and Steiner Hayward and Representative Kinnemer. The measure requires the Department of Consumer Business Services develop recommendations to create a program to reimburse the cost of oral health care for low-income COFA residents living in Oregon. There's no revenue impact, and the bill has a minimal fiscal impact, and the committee has the necessary paperwork to move the bill if the committee so desires. Testimony is available on the list.
Okay, we have David, is it Anatok, David Anderson, John Mullen, and Fred Schaefer. Whatever order you want to take.
COFA guys. I'm there.
And we're running. We need to be as brief as you, but to the point as possible, since the first one took way too long. Okay.
Madam Chair, Morris Anderson, Vice Chair General Cruz, Senate members of the Healthcare Committee. Thank you for this opportunity. For the record, my name is David Anatok. I'm here on behalf of the COFA Alliance National Network to urge your continuing support in passing of the Senate Bill 147. As you already know, last year in 2015, during the short session, you passed unanimously House Bill 4071, the first time ever COFA healthcare program, not only in Oregon, but in the United States.
that bring about, again, health care to the COFA Pacific Islanders. During the open enrollment in period of for 2016, with your help, we enrolled close to 300 individuals from the COFA Islands here in Oregon to the healthcare program. Special recognition and heartfelt thanks to the staffs and members of the Department of Consumer and Business Services for their tireless efforts and professionalism and great work in ensuring that the COFA healthcare program came through successfully this first time around. While there were many challenges overcome in the new program, we are grateful and would like to not allow perfect to stand in the way of good healthcare program for all Oregonians. During the 78th Oregon Legislative Assembly in 2015, ACR 21 was introduced and passed unanimously. The resolution acknowledged the unique treaty of the Compact of Free Association between the United States and the Republic of Marshall Islands, Federated State of Micronesia, and the Republic of Palau. The resolution mentioned the U.S. 67 nuclear bomb testing in the Marshall Islands, resulting in many health disparities, cancer, thyroids, diabetes, and then some. The resolution, in effect, sets context and justifications for earlier health care bills you passed for the COFA community in Oregon, as well as this dental care study bill. As Ray Joe Sois, Lloyd Henyon, and David Anderson put down their statement that was submitted on HOLIS, this is extremely highly needed for the COFA Islanders, and they don't have access right now to any dental except through emergencies and free clinics. Senate Bill 147 is the right path to take right now, with alternative options that we are willing to look into, making sure that this is the most affordable and creative way to bring about a health care program for the COFA Pacific Islanders. Like House Bill 4071 in 2016, we hope Oregon will again lead the way in passing and implementing legislation that will become a model to the rest of the United States, given the historical obligations that we all bear. I heard your support in passing House Bill, Senate Bill 147, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you
Let's
have.
Let's go through the panel.
Senator Montes Anderson, Vice Chair, Senator Cruz, and members of the committee. My name is David Anderson. I live in Portland in the mid-70s, and I urge support of Senate Bill 147. In the mid-70s, I was a Peace Corps volunteer out on Ujalong Atoll in the Marshall Islands, and I worked with the people who were moved off of Eniwetok so we could test nuclear and thermonuclear devices on Eniwetok. And while I was there, I was able to see firsthand the impact of the test on the Marshallese, the impact of World War II battles, and the Star Wars missile defense testing. I think it's a reasonable thing to include dental health care with the health care coverage that members of the COFA nations receive, and 147 would study that feasibility. Thank you.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Mellon with the Oregon Law Center. The mission of the Oregon Law Center is to achieve justice for low-income communities in Oregon. And what you just heard from my two colleagues are the reasons why we have a special commitment to the people who are in the COFA population. I wanted to testify today just to add to the fact that a number of us have worked along with our COFA colleagues to bring this to the attention of the legislature and to work on this issue. We formed a coalition called the Inclusion Affordability Innovation Coalition, where our values are right in our name. And so this is very much both an inclusion and affordability issue. And I would also submit that it was really an innovative piece of work that was done not only by advocates, but the Department of Consumer and Business Services in implementing House Bill 4071 from the 16th session. So the missing piece, though, is dental. And having an opportunity to study dental, and I think this could be done at a minimal cost, if any cost at all, and we could then bring back a report to the next legislative session so that the legislative body could consider adding that vital service. So, again, we would very much support you passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Questions for this panel?
Mm-hmm.
Fred Schaefer? Is DCBS in the room? Could you come forward, too?
Good
Go ahead.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Fred Schaefer. I am the national commander for the National Association of Atomic Veterans, and I'm the Oregon State commander. And I was military when I participated in the atomic testing, and so much of this has been secretive until 1996 when it was released. And not only did we nuke our troops, we nuked these people and their homeland. And I just feel that the justice needs to come forward and help support them.
Thank you very much. And the question I have for DCBS, we did get information that we do not need to send it to Ways and Means, and I was just wondering if you did the analysis, if this is something that you can absorb in the agency.
Chair Monis Anderson, I'm Elizabeth Cronin from the Marketplace at DCBS, and I can tell you that another member of the DCBS staff did a fiscal analysis, and the reason that there's no fiscal impact is because this bill is to create the work group to create the recommendation. There may be an impact of a program that is then created subsequent to that. So we can say that, yes, we can absorb the work internally of staffing an advisory group and preparing the report that's called for in the bill.
Wonderful. Okay. Any other questions? All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 147. And are we ready to go into work session? I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 147.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 147 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves.
Yes.
First, we have to move.
And request that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Okay, all in one. Okay. So Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 147 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a recommendation to remove the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Yeah.
Yes.
Just, Madam Chair, I'm going to be supporting this. I just wish we were voting just to extend the service right now. With what we've done to the peoples of that nation, we owe it to them to do this. So I hope that I'm looking forward to the report coming back so we can do the right thing.
Thank you.
I agree with you, Senator.
All right, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Meyer.
Aye.
Senator Fennell.
Aye.
Senator Steiner-Hayward.
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Monson.
Aye. Motion carries, and I know that Senator Girard is the lead, so let's have Senator Girard carry the bill.
Chair, yes. I would suggest Senator Girard carry and Senator Meyer close.
Well, Senator Steiner-Hayward is the chief sponsor.
I'd be happy to defer to Senator Beyer if you'd like to do that, Madam Chair. If you'd like to do that.
I'll be happy to.
Okay.
Can I suggest?
So did you have that, Oliver? Okay, with that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 147, and I will open a public hearing on 966. Oliver.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 966 is brought to you by the Oregon Dental Association. The measure requires individuals licensed by the Oregon Board of Dentistry to test autoclaves or other health sterilization devices at least once per week, authorizes the Oregon Board of Dentistry to adopt rules to implement the measure. No impact statements, and there are no amendments.
Great. George O'Coolidge.
Senate Bill Monis Anderson, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is George O'Coolidge, here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association in support of Senate Bill 966. Back in 2014, we worked with Senator Girard on a bill that basically codified the recommendations coming out of the Center for Disease Control in terms of sterilization and autoclave devices. And I'll quote sort of directly from the CDC, particularly around methods for high-level disinfection or sterilization. Metal and heat-stable dental instruments should be routinely sterilized between use by steam under pressure, which is autoclave, dry heat, or chemical vapor. The adequacy of sterilization cycles should be verified by the periodic use of spore testing devices at least weekly for most dental practices. And Senate Bill 1519 essentially did that. It was passed by both chambers unanimously, and it said a dentist shall test at least once per week any autoclave or heat sterilization device that is used by a dentist in order to ensure that the device is functioning properly. It became we became aware in the interim, the Board of Dentistry actually brought this to our attention, that the statute specifically talks about a dentist, but that the CDC talks about dental practices. And we know that dentistry is changing. You know, we have expanded practice dental hygienists who are operating mobile clinics, who are out in the field. You know, other forms of dental hygienists that are working in schools and other forms. And so basically this bill was just meant to update what we codified in 2014 by saying instead of a dentist, it should say a person licensed by the Oregon Board of Dentistry. And that's
thank
probably
you,
the
Mr.
most
Kirsten.
Important bill of the session.
That's great. I would like to carry this. Can we post a work session for Thursday, or will it have to be for Tuesday? It's too late. Yeah. So we, if it's all right with the committee, we'll post a work session next week then.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 966 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 831.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 831, the measure allows osteopathic and podiatric physicians to supervise, physician assistants. There are no impact statements. There is a dash two amendment posted on the list.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association, here in support of Senate Bill 831 with the inclusion of the dash two amendments. In 2013, the Oregon legislature passed a bill to add doctors of podiatric medicine to the definition of physicians in Oregon, but the statutes dealing with supervision of physician assistants were specific to MDDO. So Senate Bill 831 would allow, not mandate, the DPMs could supervise physician assistants working within the DPM scope of practice. We've worked with the PA Association, and they're neutral on the bill. Oregon Medical Association is also okay, and with the inclusion of the dash two amendments, my understanding is the osteopathic physician and surgeons of Oregon are enthusiastically neutral. No known opposition.
That's a great new word.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Are there any questions? Any problems with the bill? All right. Well, this is another one that we can then post for work session as soon as we can. So
thank you very much.
No other comments or people who want to testify on it. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 831 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 963.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, Senate Bill 963, brought to you by the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon. The measure requires insurance carriers that offer health plans on Oregon's individual group market to reimburse osteopathic physicians for osteopathic manipulative treatments determined medically necessary by the physician. There are no fiscal or revenue statements. There is a dash two posted on OLIS. Testimony is also available on OLIS.
Great. David Walls.
Morning. Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz. My name is David Walls. I'm the Executive Director for the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons of Oregon. OPSA represents over 1,500 osteopathic physician residents and students in the state of Oregon. We have the Senate Bill 963 here in support in the dash two amendments, which we hope to clarify what we'd like to do with this bill. It's very straightforward. What it states is that insurers cannot deny payment for a physician office visit, which is also called the evaluation and management, or an osteopathic manipulative treatment solely based on the fact that those services were provided on the same date of service. So it's not a mandate coverage. It doesn't impact anything between a private contract between an insurer and a physician. It simply states if a covered service, so if OMT is a covered service, and it's provided on the same date of the evaluation and management, those services can't be denied on that basis that were provided and on the same date. We have Dr. Weaver here today who can talk a little more about OMT and some of the issues we've been having with payments. But I'd like to talk a little about why we have this bill today and why it's going to be important to pass this to provide coverage for access for patients in Oregon. So OMT, osteopathic manipulative treatment, it's a manual treatment provided by an osteopathic physician where they use their hands. It's often used to address musculoskeletal issues and address issues with pain management. It's not a chiropractic adjustment. It's not physical therapy. It's a distinct form of treatment that's provided by a comprehensively trained osteopathic physicians. So osteopathic physicians in Oregon are experiencing a lot of challenges in having their office visits paid when they're providing the OMT. And one of the examples would be if a patient comes into a physician's office, the physician does the office visit, does the full evaluation and management. It's a chief complaint of pain. That physician prescribes a pain medication, writes a script, sends that patient home. They get paid in full for that evaluation and management service. We've, in the 9 years I've been with the association, never had a physician call me stating that they'd have problems getting paid in that scenario. Conversely, if a patient comes to a physician, they do the full evaluation and management, and they decide osteopathic manipulative treatment is going to be a good form of treatment for this person, then they perform the OMT, send that patient on home without a prescription medication, possibly addressing the pain at that point. We're getting calls from physicians that the evaluation and management isn't paid in those cases. So if the physician just writes the script, sends them home, the full office visit is paid. When performing OMT, oftentimes that payment's denied. One of the reasons or how this is happening is because those services are provided on the same date of service. And I'm not a billing or coding expert, but the CPT codes, how the codes are set up, that those are two distinct and separate services, and they're billed using what's called the modifier 25. We actually had an insurance carrier, Medicare insurance carrier, confirm that's the case as well, that when the dash modifier 25 is used, those are two distinct and separate services and should be paid separately. We have put into the record some information on exactly what's covered in those two services. And if we want to go into that detail, we can. But those are two, separately covered services. And the main issue is when these payments are denied, the physician really has limited options of what they can do. I mean, the one thing they can do, they can appeal that denial. That can be very costly, very time-consuming. A lot of the physicians who provide OMT are family medicine or internal medicine folks, usually small or solo group practice. If they're in rural areas, they just don't have the support staff, the resources to deal with that. The other option they can do is have the patient come back on a separate day. They can perform the evaluation and management, say, you're a great candidate for OMT, but because of the way of issues we're having, you can come back for that service. The third option is just not provide the OMT, not have that service available, and be limited to a pain medicine prescription. So none of those options really make sense. It makes no medical sense or financial sense to have a patient come back on the next day and provide that service and get it paid in full. It doesn't make any sense to deny that service, and it doesn't make sense to have that physician go through this lengthy process. With all the opioid abuse challenges in the state, you know, we shouldn't be having more barriers to these type of treatments that can provide pain relief at the point of care. So this legislative action would go a big way in addressing this issue. Again, it doesn't add a burden on insurers. It doesn't add a mandate. It just simply states if that service is covered, if it's provided on the same date of service, that those two services should get paid. And we'll let Dr. Weaver talk in great more detail, or I can answer any questions.
Let's go ahead with Dr. Weaver.
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dr. Paul Weaver. I'm a family practice physician here in Salem. I provide osteopathic services. This bill would help solve a recurring problem. Insurance companies arbitrarily decide not to pay both of those codes on the same day. The general practice is those are both paid, but in this case, Health Net's taken a stance not to. A few years ago, it was Blue Cross, so they take turns. This would solve that problem, so we don't have to fight this on a national level and the local level. And the patients end up not being treated during the time these denials are active. And I think that's pretty simple.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Questions? All right.
Can I make a comment?
Mm-hmm.
I really value our insurance colleagues out here, but every single year we see at least one bill like this where one insurance company or another has made the decision to do something that they think is going to save a little bit of money, but ultimately ends up really inconvincing patients, and we have to come in and regulate the insurance industry more, which none of us enjoys doing. And I would just urge the insurers, if you're thinking about changing something like this, this is what happened with the nurse practitioner pay parity issue. This is, I mean, I could go on and on and on. You all know the examples. I would urge the insurance company, I understand there are antitrust issues. You can't talk too much about what you're doing. But if you're going to change something like this, could you talk to each other and think about whether it's worth showing up in a legislative hearing room? Because truly, I don't like doing this. The insurance company doesn't like having to do it. Our colleagues who are osteopathic physicians and providing important treatment don't like having to do it. It's just not patient-centered care. It's not patient-centered insurance. So that's my whine of the day, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
And plea, really, more accurately, of the day. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you explain the dash twos and what changes that
mean? Oh, yes. Sorry about that. The dash two just clarifies on the on the 0.3, it says that the evaluation described in subsection 2 of the section, insurer may not deny reimbursement for an osteopathic manipulative treatment or an evaluation. So the previous one just had one. So this would cover both the evaluation and management and the OMT.
Great. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tom Holt.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. We're in opposition to this bill, and it's not out of any question of there being value in the osteopathic services. This bill is about revenue. What the bill would do, as was just explained, is that in the first office visit, then the osteopath would bill a second time for the services provided during that visit. And then, so we would have it. This is an area where there is frequently abuse by a range of providers on same day of service. I'll give you another example. We recently audited in our favor a surgery center that was billing for two surgery suites, but for one procedure, and that's the kind of abuse that can happen when you have a mandate framed in this way. There isn't a mandate on the surgery centers of this sort, but I'm just telling you that from a waste and abuse standpoint at the margins, this is an area where we do see abuse in billing, and so we oppose the bill. We pay for these kind of services. We're happy to do so when they're medically necessary, and you know, in the case of where there may be multiple visits from a to an osteopath, visit one, they get the evaluation and the treatment. They may have follow-ups where they have the treatment. They're going to get paid for that, but not two payments for one visit.
Senator Beyer.
So explain what you think are, where's the conflict there? I mean, it seems like they're separate things. The diagnosis, I mean, if the diagnosis leads to a treatment, it seems like both of them would be separate cost items.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Beyer, that's often not the case with a general practice visit. I had an office visit myself last Saturday. One office visit charge, a diagnosis was made and treatment given, one charge.
Madam Chair, so when I'm being that primary care doctor, and I have a patient come in with an abscess, right? I'm going to look at it, I'm going to diagnose it, and I'm going to treat it. And often that means an incision and drainage, which is a procedure which I bill for separately. And I get reimbursed both for the evaluation and management code and for the procedure. And I've never heard of there being a problem with both of those being done in the same day. Is that true?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Stangerhaver, I'd be happy to get back to you about that specific kind of instance. But in this area of osteopathic medicine, we consider that to be part of the office visit.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, thank you. Then I guess I'm still puzzled because. To me, osteopathic manipulation is as much a procedure as doing incision and drainage of an abscess. And if it's something that you're going to pay for anyway, and if they're going to document in the chart that they did this manipulation, if they document it and they didn't do that, then that's malpractice, basically. And I really can't imagine that you're going to have a lot of physicians willing to take the risk for some billing. And I'm also, I mean, do you have examples of this happening with osteopathic physicians? Is this a common problem? Because I'm really, I'm very surprised by this line of concern.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Hayward, if I think I understand your question, it's, you know, do we see abuses in this type of area? I'm not saying that most physicians would abuse the system, but the sad fact is that we do get abuse of the billing system.
Madam Chair, I'm not disagreeing, Mr. Holt, that you get abuses of the billing system. I get that. But when you saw your doctor on Saturday, you were given prescriptions. You didn't have a procedure done. You and I had a conversation about this outside of this hearing room. I won't go into detail. But you didn't have a procedure done. And if I, as a physician, had been your physician, I wouldn't have billed for anything other than the E&M code either. Because prescribing medication, making a diagnosis and prescribing medication, is different from making a diagnosis and doing a procedure. Those are two entirely different things. And from my patient's perspective, or from an osteopathic physician's perspective, asking the patient to come back is like saying I'm doing their annual well woman exam and I can't do their pap smear, because you're not going to pay for the pap smear that day. It leaves me completely tongue-tied. I just don't understand it at all, Mr. Hull, that concern at all.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Any other comments? All right. I think that this probably is ready for work session, and so let's post it for work session. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 963 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 237.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you send 237, the bill requires an insurance carrier that serves the individual group market in Oregon to offer at least 25% of their plans as a copayment only plan. The bill requires copayment only plans to have a single flat copayment amount on all prescription drugs paid for or reimbursed by the carrier. It also would grant the Department of Consumer Business Services rulemaking authority to implement and monitor provisions of the bill. There are no impact statements. There's a dash one post on OLIS, and testimony is available as well as on OLIS.
Okay. So Thea Zajac, Patrick Stone, and Chris Pettit.
Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee, thank you so much for taking time for us today. My name is Thea Zajac. I'm a Regional Director of Government Affairs with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. The Leukemia and Lymphoma Society exists to find cures for blood cancers and ensure that to improve the quality of life for patients and their families. As I'm sure you know, Oregon consumers who live with chronic and life-threatening diseases depend on life-saving medications to keep them alive. In the blood cancer space, innovations in new cancer treatments have increased the lifespan and quality of life for many patients. There's now some treatments where someone can be diagnosed with a type of leukemia and take a pill every day for the rest of their lives. They can live a normal life expectancy. They can go to work. They can contribute to their communities. But unfortunately, because of the way certain insurance benefits are designed, the high cost of these medications is passed on to patients, disproportionately imposing more costs on the consumers who are the very sickest. This is in part because of the increasing rate at which insurers are requiring consumers to pay a percentage of the total cost of their medication, a type of cost sharing known as co-insurance. Oregon has some of the highest co-insurances in their exchange plans in the country, with 50% co-insurances in their silver and gold standard plans. As you can imagine, a 50% amount can translate to astronomical costs for patients, thousands of dollars could be thousands of dollars for a 30-day supply of a medication. Making this even more challenging is the growing prevalence that we're seeing of high deductibles. Last year, the average combined silver deductible was about $3,700. We know that when patients can't afford their medications, they have to make dire decisions, like choosing between life-saving treatments and their groceries or their mortgage or their rent or contributing to their retirement. We know that patients cut their pills in half to try to extend those prescriptions when they can't afford them. There was a 2013 study that found that almost one in four cancer patients has not filled a prescription due to the cost of it. This bill seeks to alleviate those high co-insurances that have become common in the pharmacy benefit design plans by requiring insurers to offer at least a quarter or 25% of their plans that they sell in the individual market to have a copay-only pharmacy benefit structure, meaning that it wouldn't have those co-insurances or those percentages. It would have flat dollar amounts across the pharmacy benefit tier, and those would be reasonably graduated, and that those copays would apply pre-deductible, and that's what the Dash 1 amendment relates to. Additionally, these copay-only plans make it a lot easier for consumers to understand what they're getting when they're shopping for their insurance. If someone knows they need to take one of these medications, they can look at these plans and know exactly what their monthly out-of-pocket costs will be and know that they won't have to meet that high deductible burden at the beginning of the year. We know that there's been several legislative efforts this year trying to address the complex issue of drug costs and drug pricing. I had the honor of representing LLS on the work group that was convened by Representative Nost over the last year and a half. We, with other patient advocacy organizations, gave recommendations to that group, many of which are encompassed in this bill, and we really commend the work that's been done there. We commend them for having taken some of those recommendations into account, but we really feel like there still is a need for a legislative solution that's strictly focused on how cost sharing and transparency directly impacts patients, and for that reason, this bill is before you today. And I would also highlight that it's the only bill currently in your committee that would directly impact what a patient pays for their medications, something that's really needed right now, as I'm sure you've heard, in the healthcare environment. Two other states have enacted similar regulations that require insurers to offer at least a portion of their plans with these copay-only benefits, Montana and Colorado. I just wanted to highlight that in Colorado, they still there's been an increase in choice in the insurance market as a result. There's now plans that have copay-only benefits. There's still plans that have those co-insurances. The premiums are very comparable, so they're not markedly different. If enacted, Senate Bill 237 with this Dash 1 amendment could have a really profound impact on a lot of Oregonians living with chronic and life-threatening diseases, and would really bring the urgent relief to patients that need this today. Thank you for your consideration, and I'll take questions.
Yeah, let's finish the panel first.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be back in front of you. For the record, my name is Patrick Stone, and I am the Director of State Government Relations for the National Psoriasis Foundation. NPF is a leading nonprofit for the over 8 million Americans living with psoriatic disease, and we are proud to be celebrating our 50th anniversary as a national nonprofit that is headquartered in Portland, Oregon. I want to thank the committee for taking the time to discuss the issue of access and high out-of-pocket costs. I know that you all have probably been bombarded by phone calls, emails, letters, and requests for meetings from constituents, so we thank you for addressing an issue that is obviously a very serious concern to all those constituents. Patient and provider groups are looking forward to the legislature acting on a bill that can provide better access to health care for all Oregonians without driving up premiums. The legislation before you today is a straightforward and well-thought-out means for this legislator to take a shot at driving down costs in the healthcare system while increasing access. The healthcare system has a lot of players, insurers, drug companies, PBMs, pharmacists, hospitals, but lost in that shuffle is often the patient and provider voice. This bill represents that voice in its purest form. Chronic disease represents the largest challenge to the solvency of the healthcare system. If we cannot address how we will provide affordable health care options to those living with a chronic disease and the comorbidities that are often come with it, we will never come to a point of success. The issue goes beyond just purely allowing people who have a pre-existing condition to purchase insurance with a low premium. What those with a chronic disease really need is the ability to purchase a plan that provides access to copays that are affordable. If the only option you have is to purchase a plan that has a 50% coinsurance for specialty drugs, then you aren't going to end up having an insured person who is unable to afford that payment, and as a result, doesn't adhere to the drug regimen prescribed by their doctor, and as furthermore, as a result, is more sick and consequently impacts the healthcare system in a negative fashion. Purely just allowing people with a chronic disease to have health care isn't necessarily a means to access. By setting a fixed amount of plans in the commercial space that must provide copay-only plans, we will provide an ability for consumers to make a choice regarding their health care that best suits their needs. I urge the committee to report Senate Bill 237 favorably, and thank you for your time today.
Great. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the board. It's my pleasure to be back here. My name is Christopher Pettit, and I was diagnosed with severe plaque psoriasis about 17 years ago at the age of 13. At my worst, it was it covered about 85% of my body. So you can imagine that wasn't too much fun. This means that my body was covered in itchy plaques that would crack and bleed, and kind of like imagine having chapped lips all over your body. That kind of feeling, so not too pleasant. So the pain and the itching at times was so uncomfortable, it kept me up at night. So you can imagine not getting much sleep. This also messed with my psyche and my emotions. I suffered years of embarrassment, you know, family members even. I had a family member tell me once they didn't want me to come over because they would have to clean up after me. So, which is kind of funny because we do go over there from time to time. And in the past, they made sure to have a sheet put down over the couch just to catch the parts of me that fell off. I am thankful, though. I'm thankful. I met my wife at a pretty young age, and my skin didn't bother her, fortunately. We've been married for over 10 years and have 3 kids. And fortunately, so far, none of them have this. So far, fingers crossed. This also impacted, you know, our intimacy life. I won't go into any details. When I take my kids to parks or restaurants or any public places, it's difficult because, you know, I get weird looks from little kids too, especially if it's like play dates or, you know, going to the park. You know, parents tend to keep their kids away because they don't know what it is. It's just, you know, sorry, I lost my place here. Because they thought it was contagious, mostly. Going to the public pool was out of the question, so I'm not going to go into that. Not only was I treated like a leper, but the times I actually did go to the pool, I actually did go a couple times, the chlorine was unbearably, it was horrible. It burned really bad. A few years ago, me and my family went to California, which was really tough. We went to San Francisco, and I had to wear sweaters most of the time while I was down there, and that's never comfortable in 75-degree weather. So as you can all imagine, this also affected my self-confidence. Because of that, my work life suffered. You know, having a family to support and only really qualifying for blue-collar minimum wage jobs that really don't have very good insurance to begin with, that was really hard when it came to my health issues, especially this. It was years of just, you know, using the lotions and the creams and not really getting the relief that I needed because of those costs of those, you know, the medicines that I really needed. Last year, my wife started working for the National Psoriasis Foundation, and she actually did some more research on the biologics that would actually, you know, give me the relief that I needed. And this also meant, you know, getting into some boxing matches with the insurance companies. After doing that for a while, the first biologic I was on, we were actually able to get onto a program that covered me and just gave me a $5 copay, just until the insurance decided that they were going to help cover it. Unfortunately, that biologic stopped working, so I had to switch to another one. But again, fortunately, I'm using that word a lot, fortunately, this one also offered the same kind of program. So I've my skin's been clear for about a year now. This bill really needs to be passed because there's people out there who have this disease, and it is absolutely terrible. And they deserve to be able to afford the medicine they need so they can feel the relief. Please pass this bill, and we support you passing this bill.
So thank how you. Much does your treatment cost?
I think without the help, it's like, I take it once a month, it's like $8,000 per, so it's not cheap.
but what is your share of it?
I pay the copay, the $5 copay. That's it. It's a 2-year program. It's called Covered Till You're Covered. It's something they do until, if ever, the insurance company decides to cover it. So,
okay. Questions for this panel? Thank you. Is it Medina McGuire Smith and Lee Mercer?
Good afternoon, Chair Senator Mona Sanderson and Vice Chair Senator Cruz and the Distinguished Committee, Healthcare Committee. My name is Madonna McGuire Smith, and I have the privilege of serving as the Executive Director of the Hemophilia Foundation of Oregon. And I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 237. I've had the opportunity to speak to many of you before, but I'd like to sort of reintroduce myself. My husband and I are raising 3 children in Corvallis, and like many other families, we're busy and very active in schools and local community. My 3 children and my husband all live with a bleeding disorder called von Willebrand disease, or better known as VWD. So you can just call it VWD. Essentially, they don't produce enough protein that is needed in the blood clotting process. So because of my unique position of being both the mother of children with a severe bleeding disorder and also my role as a representative of the bleeding disorders community in Oregon, I have an interesting perspective and a personal knowledge of the challenges of high out-of-pocket costs. I think it is essential that when all of the healthcare legislation that we see today at the state and national level, that we remember that healthcare decisions being made affect real, ordinary people's lives. Let's focus on the consumers that have to live day to day making decisions about what they can buy and what they can't buy. It's not about pharmaceutical companies. It's not about insurance companies. It's about regular, ordinary, active, normal people who have jobs and work hard to raise their families as best they can. The Hemophilia Foundation of Oregon, or HFO, represents more than 500 families and individuals living with bleeding disorders in Oregon and Southwest Washington. The mission of the organization is to enhance the quality of life of individuals with inherited bleeding disorders and their families through advocacy, assistance, outreach, education, and research support. So let me give you a few facts. There are 2 main bleeding disorders, hemophilia and von Willebrand's disease. Both are inherited, and both are caused by a deficiency in proteins required for normal blood clotting. Patients use products from human plasma or animal cells that produce proteins and help control their bleeding. As you can imagine, these life-saving medications are incredibly expensive. About 20,000 people in the United States are affected with hemophilia, and approximately 1% of the population is affected with VWD. 1% is a really high number. If you take the numbers of Oregon, that's about 40,000 people that live in the state of Oregon that could be affected with VWD, but 90% of those people don't know they have it. Also, it takes about 16 years for a diagnosis of VWD. So that was a statistic provided by the CDC. So as I mentioned earlier, my husband and 3 children live with a bleeding disorder. 2 of them are severe and require regular infusions of blood. And when I say infusions, I mean they find a vein with the needle themselves, and they put it into the vein and push in the blood product that they need. It typically costs my son, because I have a son and a daughter that are severe, about $150,000 to $200,000 of medication costs annually. So I have two of those that cost that much. My husband has a great job. We have really good insurance. And even with that, our out-of-pocket costs are $8,000 every year just for our medical copays. So we hit those maximums very early. In fact, both of our children have already, the two younger ones have already hit that. So we've already paid out $4,000, and it's mid-March. So we have really great jobs. We work hard all year. We save that money because January we know we're going to have to pay out of pocket to pay that. So simply put, Senate Bill 237 just gives people a chance to plan for their prescription drug costs. It doesn't ask for a handout. It doesn't ask for a lot of extras. It just simply says that people need the opportunity to plan for and budget for those costs. So copay versus coinsurance. I know there's a lot of legislation dealing with health care and the high cost of prescription drugs, both nationally and locally. There are a lot of voices out there trying to get it right, and I appreciate that. That's fantastic. I hope that we do get it right at some point. Please just remember, at the end of the day, it's about people. Salaries have not kept up with the rising cost of goods and services in the marketplace, so it's harder and harder for families to make ends meet. This bill will allow those in the marketplace insurance plans to work out their finances and plan for it. So thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you, and I'm available for questions.
Let's finish the panel.
Chair Monis-Anderson and committee and staff, my name is Lee Mercer, president of Healthcare for All Oregon. We're a statewide organization with 120 member organizations, 150 endorsing businesses, and about 20,000 activists on our database pushing for universal publicly funded health care. In the meantime, we'd like to encourage bills to improve the cost and efficacy of health care in Oregon. We support SB 237, and I sent a link to you all to a new film by Richard Master, the CEO of a corporation in Pennsylvania that did a film on healthcare last year. This year's film is a documentary on the cost of drugs in America and the cost to our economy and businesses especially of the current costs of drugs. And I'd encourage you to watch that in your free time. And thank you for your time.
Great. Questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Let us call up Elise Brown and Tom Holt.
Chair Moss Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt of Cambia Health Solutions, here in opposition to Senate Bill 237. This idea of a requirement to offer copay-only plans was discussed at great length in the interim group on high drug costs that I was a part of, and a number of others were, and it was not adopted as part of the package that came out of that. For a couple of basic reasons. One, while we all share the concern and frustration about the underlying, sometimes astronomical, costs of drugs and the inexplicable routine high levels of cost increases that we see, and we share the frustration of consumers who then, when they have a need for a high-cost drug, they show up at the pharmacy, and the pharmacy's happy to hand it over as long as there's a very substantial copay made. This bill doesn't answer the underlying problem, and our concern is that it's taking one aspect of the benefit, and the balloon's going to pop out somewhere else. Within the constraints of the ACA and the so-called metal-tier plans, we have to design a benefit with cost sharing for a whole range of services, whether it's prescription drugs or other things, and try to strike a balance across the whole spectrum, and then deliver for consumers the lowest premium rate possible. This bill would have us really in a position of having to simply either cut other benefits in order to provide a very generous pharmacy benefit with low copays and no coinsurance, or raise premium, or some combination of the two. So we just don't think it's a good solution. And it would also insulate manufacturers of drugs from the one thing they fear most, consumer pressure. When consumers have very low copays, they don't see the cost of the drug. And so they're insulated from that. And that's one big reason why manufacturers make coupons for their products available. And you can go online and find a coupon for everything from Advil to the gigantically expensive specialty drugs for those copays, is to take that barrier and pressure away. So, you know, while we sympathize with the concerns that have been raised, we just think this is the wrong solution at this time.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Elise Brown for America's Health Insurance Plans. And AHIP is the National Trade Association of Health Plans across the country. And I won't repeat, Tom did a good job of outlining why we're here in opposition. And I want to add, in addition to AHIP member Cambia beside me, Providence and Pacific Source and Kaiser and Moda have all signed on in an opposition letter, which I believe you have before you. So I wanted to call that out for the record also. You know that we've been before you a couple times this session on similar bills, those being Senate Bill 526 and Senate Bill 272. Similar in that they're bills that attack our ability to manage the cost of high-cost drugs and our plan benefits. And this is another one that goes to that point and does nothing to solve the real problem. Even in the earlier testimony, we heard lots of sympathetic testimony, but nothing to say that goes beyond the middlemen. We're the middlemen. We're the payers. But the price starts at the top, and people should be asking, why do those drugs have to cost so much money? And until we can peel away the layers and answer that question, this bill and others that are before you are not going to be helpful to plan members in Oregon and will only drive up premiums. So here, again, in support of my member here from Cambia, and that we stand in opposition to this bill. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Yep. The final two people are, Peter
Paris,
Paris and BJ Kavanaugh?
Good morning, Senator Mons Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Peter Pariso. I'm with Cascade AIDS Project in Portland, Oregon. We represent nearly 7,000 people living with HIV in Oregon and thousands more who are impacted by the disease. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 237, ensuring access to prescription medications. And I won't go into the reason why we're supporting this bill is primarily around the issue of medication adherence. Thea, my colleague, did an excellent job explaining why high cost-sharing measures negatively impact medication adherence. And from our perspective, this is a real public health issue. The National HIV AIDS Strategy prioritizes medication adherence as one of the methods for ending the epidemic. If you can get an HIV-positive patient into care and adherent to other medication, they're going to be 97% less likely to transmit the disease. Likewise, there are several one preventative therapy called pre-exposure prophylactic therapy that is a way for people who are HIV negative to take an HIV drug as a one pill a day regimen as a preventative measure. But that too requires that they be adherent to their medications. Both of those therapies have very high rates of effectiveness. If you can keep someone adhere to the medication, they're going to be significantly, nearly 100% less likely to transmit the disease. And that is how we're going to end the epidemic. This cost-sharing measure, or this Senate Bill 237, addresses the cost-sharing issue and really gets to the point of allowing people to remain adherent to their medication. Truvada, which is the the prescription drug used for both PrEP and for one of the HIV therapies can easily cost $2,000 a month. So if you show up to your pharmacy January, you're going to be hit with a pretty significant bill, even after a rebate that's offered by the manufacturer. And that can lead to people taking drug holidays, people not being adherent to their medication, and making other choices for their lives. I don't want to lessen the the impact that this bill has on the individual, but from a public health perspective, it's critical to maintaining our effectiveness in the fight against HIV. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is B.J. Kavanaugh, and I am Executive Director of 1 in 4 Chronic Health. Like my colleague Thea, I also had the opportunity to serve on the work group that was started by Representatives Greenlich and Nose. And one of the things that was most obvious coming out of this was the ability for patients to be able to afford the medications that are critical for them to take on an ongoing basis, like HIV. And what I point out today is National HIV Awareness Day, where we're asking advocates and HIV service organizations from around the country to reach out to Congress and let them know how concerned we are about the congressional bill for healthcare, the ACA replacement. This is not a one-shot cure. This is going to help some of the symptoms. But as Peter said, one of the things that this will do is it will allow that people are able to better plan their medication access and know that this is what they're facing at the beginning of a year and hopefully be able to ensure regular adherence to medication. In the case of HIV drugs, the price of the medication themselves has not risen at the same rate as deductible or cost of insurance has. And we know this for a reason. We know this not only from the data, but we also know that HIV is one of the drugs that is federally and state funded to be able to provide prescriptions for people necessary, because obviously having people take pills is better than people dying in hospitals at early ages. So we're able to see that there's not a lot of science or evidence showing why a drug that 3-4 years ago maybe cost me $50 a month in a copay is now 50% of the cost of the medication and or copay. We just don't have the data to market that. That's why I think that this is something that would be helpful to this. And, you know, we speak of transparency. And again, I don't want to bemoan the fact here, but the lack of transparency from insurance plans as to what they purchase a drug for, how much they're marking the drug up, and what decisions or how they make decisions around where to put drugs on tiers is very important for patients to be able to understand in making treatment decisions. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you before you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? As you know, we have Senator Steiner Hayward and Senator Cruz working on some of these bills to see which ones we can get out of committee. And we'll probably, hopefully, have that information within before work session deadline.
Before work session deadline is the best we can promise you, Madam Chair.
Well, okay. Whether it's deadline of 17 or 18, we're not sure, but.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 237. And Oliver, are we done for the day? Okay, we're adjourned. Okay, we're adjourned.